Hi there, Shan Chi here, Executive Director at Byron Writers Festival. And you're listening to the Deep Dives podcast series recorded live at Byron Writers Festival in 2023. Our first session, titled Nothing Bad Ever Happens Here, is a beautifully raw and uplifting conversation between Heather Rose and Jill Eddington.
Ooh. Good morning and welcome everyone to the first morning of the Byron Bay Writers Festival here on its beautiful new site. Doesn't it look fantastic? And in Bangalore, the centre really of our region, our Northern Rivers region, and held of course on the glorious land of the Bundjalung Nation. And let me pay, and I'm sure Heather's too, our respects to the original storytellers of this nation. I'm Jill Eddington and I'm thrilled to be here today in conversation with Heather Rose about her new memoir, Nothing Bad Ever Happens Here. It's a gorgeous book, as you can see, and what an evocative name right from the start. Can I just remind you a little bit of housekeeping? Please turn your phones off or onto silent. And just a note, no questions today, so we've got an hour of, and I hope that I can do it justice and ask all the questions that Heather wants to respond to. And there will be, just a reminder, a book signing, of course, at the end of this. Heather does have to dash off pretty early because she's got another commitment. So there are pre-signed books. Go and line up, get books signed, personalised. If she has to dash off, she'll be back again tomorrow and is happy to do some personal signing for you tomorrow. So let me introduce Heather for anyone who doesn't know, and I'm gathering by the size of this crowd, most of you do. And Heather is an award-winning fiction writer, winner of the Stella Prize for her novel, The Museum of Modern Love. This latest book, Nothing Bad Ever Happens Here, is a beautiful, compelling, poignant, and at times surprising memoir. It's a story of grief, love, courage, and joy, which brings wonder and comfort, really, to readers. For me, it captured an intersection of nature, human experience, and sheer awe, both for Heather and for life in general. So thank you for your work, Heather, and would you please welcome Heather to the stage?
Thank you. Thank you.
She's feeling the heat. She's from Tasmania. It's rather hot up here. Heather, it's not something I usually do with a book, but I'm going to ask you to start at the beginning because I think everybody needs to completely understand that little girl that Heather was, where you grew up, what your family was like, and somewhat idealistic background, I think. Can you start it and tell us about Heather, the little girl?
Hello, Byron Bay. It's so beautiful to be here. This is the first time I've actually been to Byron Bay Writers Festival, so it's such a pleasure to be here with you all. Thank you for coming along. Thank you. So little Heather was the third of four children in a family in Hobart, Tasmania. My dad was a public servant and my mum was an administrative secretary. I had two older brothers and then me and my little sister. We lived in a, you know, one of those very modest middle class sort of satellite suburbs that comes out of a town, and my parents had built the house having moved from a very small little shack into that house when I was only 3 months old. So it was the only house I'd ever known. It was just above the beach on a beach called Blackman's Bay, to those of you who know Hobart. And it was a spectacular place to grow up because the sunrise came up right across from my window every morning. There was a beach below, as I said. We ran about. It was a barefoot childhood of incredible freedom. And because we were the first house on that new subdivision, I lived in a world of paddocks that was slowly being taken over by more and more housing infrastructure. But mostly we just ran wild in the sand dunes and the ponds that existed in the paddocks behind the house. And then I had two sets of grandparents, both very close by, within a couple of kilometres of us. My mum's parents were, he was a barber, and my grandmother was an accountant. And my... a bookkeeper, she would remind me. She always wanted to go to university, but it didn't happen for women in her generation the way it is so wonderful that it happens now. And my other grandparents, my dad's parents, I spent a lot of time with them because we always had school lunch at Nan Rose's. So that was pretty spectacular. She lived at the bottom of the school oval. But my mum's parents built a shack down on the Tasman Peninsula, a tiny little fibro shack. And every summer holidays, every Easter holidays, every Christmas holidays, long weekends, we went to the shack. And that became such an important part of my childhood and of me as a person, because I spent, I feel like I spent my childhood with a fishing line in my hand. My granddad took us out fishing a lot. I especially loved fishing, so my mornings were on this milky calm bay on the Tasman Peninsula with a little hand line, catching flathead for breakfast, taking them home. Granddad would clean them, we'd throw them in a pan with butter and eat them for breakfast. And that was... I lived in a world that was idyllic, absolutely idyllic in so many ways. And it was the 60s. I was born in 1964. So we didn't have the kind of interruptions to our processing of life. Life was just straight in front of us. We didn't have a television. My parents didn't want a television, so I started reading early. And... yeah, it was an idyllic, delightful way to grow up, and I feel so privileged to have grown up in an era where we had so much freedom.
Even at school, it sounds like your school was a beautiful, small and caring and wonderful place. I actually asked Heather, would she choose a passage to read to you, just so you can get a sense of her voice and the cadence and rhythm of this memoir. And she's chosen something right from that schoolyard, and we just thought we might share that with you now.
So this is the first chapter, and it's called Sky. And there is a little quote from Hafez, the Sufi poet, that says, "May I speak to you like we are close and locked away together." Here she is standing in the schoolyard. She is 6 years old, dressed in a crisp green uniform. Other children are on the swings and seesaw, but she has taken herself off to stand alone under the eucalyptus at the edge of the playground. She gazes up through its broad branches to the sky above. "Hello," she says. "I'm ready. Tell me what to do. Make use of me." She might have chosen to do this at the small church where she attends Sunday school, but instead she does it here because it feels as if this big tree must have a direct connection to whoever is in charge. Does anyone answer back? They do not. Yet she feels better for having declared herself willing to be of service. She has reported for duty. Physicists now know that 70% of the known universe is dark energy. Dark matter is another 25%. Once we thought we knew all about life, but it turns out everything we think of as reality is less than 5%. Crumpets and honey, hockey sticks, sailing boats, temples, shopping centres, literature, the pharmaceutical industry, mathematics, every scientific discovery, every plant, animal or virus below the sea and above, the planets and the stars we can name and all those we can't. This galaxy and the 200 billion other galaxies that comprise the known universe, everything that has been created, constructed, calculated, measured or observed by humans, amounts to a mere fragment of existence. 95% is hidden from us, invisible, unknown, only to be imagined or sensed. Yet it's present everywhere. In every moment, in everything around us, and everything that is us. Believing and belonging occupy a great deal of human life. What to believe, how to belong. All of it is a mystery that we fill with stories. Standing under that tree in my primary school playground is not my first memory, yet it remains vivid. I will grow up and travel the world, and I will travel the inner places of heart and mind, always curious. What is this thing called life? Why am I here? For decades now, I've asked strangers if something ever happened that they couldn't explain. Something outside the normal. To my surprise, I discovered that everyone had a story of a guiding hand, a strange connection, a reassuring presence, something life-saving or life-affirming, something more than a coincidence. Everyone had experienced something that gave them a sense that there was more to life than could be seen, touched, or verified. I could write a memoir about travelling, the writing life, or my love of baking cakes. But I'm still that girl under the tree who wants to get to the big conversation, to the heart of things. So here are some stories about life and death, about experiences that have no easy explanation, but which happen nevertheless. The unknown, that 95%, maybe it's an invitation for compassion. Life is a process of forgiveness for the choices we make in order to be ourselves.
Thanks, Hannah. So the 95% is definitely something that this book is trying to lead us down the path to discover. And I think you're right. I don't think anyone can read this and not have a moment of reflection on their own experiences and find something happen. But I do have a feeling that you were more curious and more imaginative and possibly more spiritual right at that as a little girl than many of us. Am I right? Were there other things other than that tree? Were there more experiences that made you different to other children?
I don't know, because I can only have my own experience, but my dad is a devout Christian and he really exemplifies the beautiful qualities of Christianity, kindness, charity towards all, you know, malice to none. He's a beautiful, non-judgmental, warm and gracious human being. And my mum is a devoted agnostic. So the family conversations were kind of interesting, yeah? I mean, they also have completely different political views, completely different ideas on most everything, and they divorced after about 21 years. So I think because Dad was going off to church and he had this sense of connection with something big and powerful called God, and Mum was, heaven is here on earth. There isn't anything beyond this reality. If you're not appreciating the moment, you're missing it altogether. So as a child, I think the opportunity to grow up between those two paradigms was such a big invitation. And yes, I certainly think I had... I've only just realised, been brought to realise in the last year that I'm one of those highly sensitive people. I feel everything intensely, and I think we'll find that most writers and artists are highly sensitive people. So, yes, there were times that I felt things and sensed things that I couldn't have explained what they were. And even that sense of standing under that gum tree, and that gum tree is still there in that playground. When I was there, the school only had 60 students, but now it's three different campuses across the suburb, and it's... that the tree is still there, and it's this glorious big gum tree. And, you know, I don't know why I did that, but I felt this sense that my life ought to have a purpose, and it would be good if someone could tell me what it was.
It's a fascinating story. And but that beautiful childhood gets shaken up. It gets shattered, really, not shaken up. Would you like me to tell the story of that and then you can reflect on it for us? It's really hard to talk about it endlessly, I'm sure, Heather. What happens one day is this very beautiful grandfather and her older brother head off to go fishing. And it's important you know this, and because I think it makes the whole of the rest of our conversation relevant. And they go out and a squall comes up and the boat tips over and they both drown. So Heather, in an instant, at the age of 12, I think, Heather, loses her very close grandfather and her brother. And we can only all imagine what that does to a 12-year-old, a very, you know, at that moment of adolescence and you know, maturity that a child is reaching at 12. Can your reflections on that day, you know, you have extraordinary, I think you had the most amazing visions around that day as well, which you may be able to share with us too. And I guess what happens, though, it's the grief that is insurmountable after that moment, that your whole family changes, everything about your life changes. Can you reflect on either that day, if you can for us and tell us that story, or just about the grief and what happened in the family from that point on?
Yeah, I thought perhaps in writing a memoir I would release some of these stories and, in fact, never have to tell them again.
What were you thinking?
And I sort of had a notion when I started on this, you know, world of the book coming out and starting to do events about the memoir, that if I told that story often enough, it would stop having power over me and I would stop feeling it. But that's not true. As anyone who lives with PTSD knows, that we can't just put that stuff away. And if we do, it's a really unhealthy thing to do, that we have to be with what is true for us and what we felt, and to be able to honour it for the gifts that it brings as well as the challenges. And, of course, the greatest challenge of all was that my family was destroyed. My mother and father barely spoke to each other again after that. My brother was her best friend. And, you know, it was just... she was unspeakably destroyed by it. And I'm sure there are people in the audience who've lost siblings and who've lost children, and you know what that is like. And I've had the most amazing amount of letters from people sharing that with me. Grief is a long song. That's one of the things I talk about in the memoir. And so to somehow go on from that kind of experience in a broken family, which did its best for 4 years before my parents did divorce, you know, it asks something of a person. But as a 12-year-old, I started, of course, to create patterns in my behaviour that were helpful, I thought. And I figured that if I tried to keep everyone happy, that would be a really good idea. But a 12-year-old taking on that, it creates a very difficult pattern to live with in life, especially when you get yourself into difficult relationships later on. And it, you know, my sister was 9 years old, I was 12. And as Jill said, I had an experience in the morning where I actually woke up out of a dream. I've always had very vivid dreams, and I woke up out of a dream where I was drowning in the dream, but then I realised I wasn't me, I was my brother. And I wanted to run in to my parents' bedroom and say, we've got to go and save Byron. But it was a dream, and I'm 12, and of course, I didn't think they would believe me, and not in any unhealthy way, but they would just say, Heather, it's just a dream. And so when the policeman came to the door, my dad had just stepped out for a few minutes to go and grab something from the shop because it was the school holidays and mum was at work, and I opened the door and a policeman was standing there and he said, "Do you know Byron Kent Rose and Leonard Keith Burgess?" And I said to him, "Yes, one is my brother and one is my grandfather." And I was as tall then as I am now. And I think he at first thought I was older than I was. But when I said that, he realised that I wasn't, and he got this terrible look on his face. And I've always had enormous compassion for policemen ever since, because for all the things that we sometimes rail about with speeding tickets, they have to do that job too. And I said, "Would you like to come in?" Because that's what we did in those days. And he said, "No, I'll wait in the car." And I turned around and my sister was standing in the hallway and she said, "What did he want?" And I said, "Byron and Granddad are dead." Because I'd had the dream. I just knew right then. And that sense of knowing has been a gift to me in my life, but it's also, it comes with great challenges. I'm sure there are many of you here who've had experiences like this and who, you know, I want you to know that since writing the memoir, I have received the most enormous number of messages on social media, sometimes in other forms, but mostly on social media, of people saying, "Thank you. Thank you for saying that life is not just, you know, some straightforward experience. It's a complex experience, and we feel a great deal, and it's so great to acknowledge that we are deeply feeling people."
Thank you, Heather. It's just it's incredible, that level of insight. I think it was page 15. There was a quote though that I thought you used, which is, "Grief is when nothing can be done, and there is no going back to fix it, and there's no going forward without knowing that it can never be fixed." And it's really, I found, a very helpful thing to focus on, because it is about accepting it. And so I wanted to move on to Heather as a teenager and then as an adult. And we've got a roller coaster of a story here. So
how many of you have read the memoir?
Yeah, how many?
Okay.
Wow, you've got some dedicated, but you want to hear the stories anyway, don't you? And I think the thing that blew me away was you as a teenager, as doing your what we call HSC, and in I'm assuming you did too, on your own in the house. So you're 17 going on 18, and by this stage the rest of the family has left and you're alone in the home, from this dedicated, beautiful family into being alone and doing your HSC. I mean, you're a pretty high achiever. You were doing all sorts of...
I did 11 subjects in HSC.
11 subjects. You were also, meantime, doing extraordinary physical things. You were a kayaker, you were doing...
Hockey player, sailor, yeah.
All of the above. So physical, cerebral, you know. But here you are alone at that very poignant moment in your life. You don't deal with the sadness as most of us would, and that, well, as many people do, in that you know, we would then wallow and think and ponder, and you decide to go off and have this roller coaster of experiences. You decide to go and embrace a world, to take yourself out of that small world that you've been brought up in and go and head out there. Can we, I mean, it includes Buddhism, heroin, visions, you know, all sorts of extraordinary things that many of us would never ponder. Can you go through what was in your mind in that first step when you went overseas, went travelling? What were you thinking? What were you feeling? What were you wanting to do? And then we'll talk through some of those experiences as we go.
Yeah, so I finished year 12. I couldn't afford to go to university, so I got a couple of jobs, a night job and a day job, and I saved up to travel overseas because I thought that you could leave the past behind. Mm-hmm. So I went first of all to Southeast Asia, and I made my way to Thailand and a Buddhist monastery that I had heard about, and spent, you know, 2 or 3 months in silent retreat there out on the border of Laos. I very seriously considered becoming a nun. Mm. I think by that stage I was looking for some deeper sense of purpose still, that same little girl at six, still looking for my deeper sense of purpose. But also it was only in writing the memoir that I, you know, one of the challenges, and I'm sure there's a lot of you who, how many of you will admit to being writers in the room? You can just put your hand up a little bit. I know it's stressful. Yeah. So writing is really hard, and we do it for lots of different reasons. But writing a memoir, which I'd never done before, and had avoided doing, let's be honest, was, in order to do that successfully, I had to go back and live inside the me that was six and the me that was 12 and the me that was 17 and the me that was 19. And it was very confronting to go back and do that, to see how vulnerable I actually was and how broken I was. And the beautiful thing about that was realizing that I had actually been enormously brave, and I didn't see that at the time, and I didn't consider myself a person of courage. I was looking, I wanted to look at the world. After my brother had died, he appeared to me twice in the days after his death, once in the doorway a few days after his death and once about 2 or 3 weeks later. And on both occasions, he smiled at me. You know, I don't know what that was, but it was Byron standing in the doorway, a little bit see-through, but Byron, and he was smiling at me as if to reassure me that it was really okay. He was okay. I didn't need to worry about him. Hmm. And something about those experiences, I think, caused me to believe that actually there was nothing to fear from death, that I could live my life as fully as I wanted to, because if death came, it wasn't something scary. Byron seemed fine with it. So I could live very fully. And I think also I wanted to live fully because he hadn't, because he didn't get to. And so I really only connected with that feeling a few years ago when I was up here in Queens, actually in Queensland at a meditation, and he appeared again in a very visceral moment after I'd done 5 days of meditating. And I realised, he said to me, "I died so that you would know two things, to never be afraid of death and to live every day." Yeah.
Because I was going to ask you, well, firstly, would you have made a good nun?
I'm not sure. I mean, I loved the silence. I loved the isolation. I loved the mind. I mean, I love how, for all of us who meditate, I love how big the mind can get, how big the sense of, immersion into something that makes me so minuscule and unimportant, and yet there's a sense of the wonder of this creation. I don't know what this is, and one of the reasons I didn't really want to write a spiritual memoir, but my publishers insisted, was that, because I really did write a much bigger book with all sorts of travel stories and everything and recipes, but they said, you should focus on the spiritual thing. And one of the reasons I was resistant to that was because I didn't want people to think I had any answers. So please don't think that what I say has, you know, is of necessarily of any value to you. We each have our own journey in this regard. But there was such a sense in the monastery of being utterly unimportant, as I said, but also that this enormous feeling of being human and yet being part of nature and part of a universe, that's very intoxicating. I liked it. Mm. And I don't know whether I would have persisted, but it was great because at the end there came a conversation on Sundays. We were allowed to ask questions of the head monk, and we would gather in this small room and he'd answer one or two questions. The rest of the time we were in silence all the time. And a nun asked, "How do you know that what we do here makes any difference in the world?" And it's a great question, yeah? But what caught me was in the world, and it took me back out, and I suddenly thought, oh, in the world. Oh, that's right, I'm in a monastery, in a rice paddy, in a little village, and back there's Bangkok, and it just took me back out, and I suddenly had this much bigger sense of the world, and my inner voice said, I'm meant to be out there. Mm. I've got things to do.
Mm. You were a very physical person, as we mentioned earlier, but were you always a risk taker?
I don't know, Jill. It's possible I don't have a very good idea of what risk is.
or I was just thinking, because that was my original question, then when I think you just explained to us about how you realised that Byron, you know, you wanted to live because Byron hadn't. And so perhaps those two, perhaps you, it was more about the risk was about living. I mean, there is inherently risk in living. So
I think the risk was not to live. Mm-hmm. I think for me the greatest risk, and it probably still remains that way, is not to make the most of every moment.
Mm. That's fascinating and interesting. So there were just a few things, and I know that anyone who's read the book will have had a moment somewhere in the book that they've gone, oh, how did she do that? Or why did she do that? But we might come to the why a little later. And I just thought, you know, it is a little bit curious to many of us. And there's the spider story, the huntsman oh, yes. stories, and you know, I have to say, the heroine story, which, you know, it's in the book, so we can talk about it. That to me was risky, and yet you seem to move through those experiences with some delight, you know, and with an ability. So do you want to just share which of those stories, which was the scariest, which was the most frightening thing for you along the way, or the one that disturbed you the most, and the on reflection?
On reflection, back, yeah. I think the heroine story, which was a very brief time in my life in Thailand. I've actually never talked about this publicly before because no one's ever asked.
Is that okay? We're in Byron Bay. We're allowed up here.
Very beautiful setting, Koh Samui back in, 1983, exquisitely beautiful, tiny little cottage on the beachfront, a very glamorous bungalow next door with some very glamorous, tall German men who, looking back, were sort of having such a fabulous time together, clearly beautifully dressed in linen and striped linen too. And they, they ordered tea and food to be delivered. And because my bungalow was right next door to them, I got to know them. And I had... by this stage, I had malaria, although I didn't know it was malaria. And I'd just come out of a very, very bad experience of malaria, out of that fevered dream state that's really compelling. And I was just glad to be alive again, quite honestly. I had actually thought that I'd had an experience in the weirdness of those fever dreams that malaria brings, where I saw two people at the end of the bed and one of them said to the other person, "Do you think she's going to die?" And the other one said, "Maybe." I remember at some point thinking, this is not a good state to be in. This is not good. And I didn't know what was causing it. So when I came back from that, and these beautiful men who were probably in their late 20s, and I was 19, offered me a little teaspoon with some white powder on it and the hammock, and I could take myself away. And I realised that I could take myself away from that pain that was still in me of running away from my home and having to leave behind my family, and thinking that I could free myself from the trauma. Mm. And I remember on this one afternoon, I recount this in the book, but I went down this sort of slippery pathway and found a door, and the paint was coming off it. It was a black door with a beautiful brass sort of handle, and it was, you know, peeling off. And I put my hand on the door and I thought, oh, this is the door of death. I just have to pull the handle and I can go. I can be free of this. And then, of course, thank goodness, a wiser voice said to me, not now, not today. And I came back up and the light was so beautiful, you know, the light on the sea in Thailand, that beautiful azure turquoise sparkle, a little gentle breeze, the crash of the sea, the hum of the insects, the beautiful greenness of the leaves. I was enchanted, re-enchanted by the world. But it scared me a little bit. I remember thinking, that was too close. Mm. I don't think I should do anything like that again, which is funny in retrospect. But it's a horrible thing to do. But it's given me enormous compassion, I have to say, for heroin, people who need heroin, who become addicted to heroin, because it is a beautiful way to numb yourself of everything. And I look at those people now and I think, wow. There's a lot of stuff you need to numb yourself from, and that's devastating, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
After those experiences, you then find some sort of... you make a decision, I suppose, to actually go and experience particular purposeful, you know, retreats, and like there's meditation and things. But what I did want to talk about was your experience, obviously, in the USA and with the Native Americans. We're going to run out of time if we talk too long about it, because we could have the whole session about it. But what drew you to that? Again, it was a very extreme practice that you decided to become part of. Can you talk about that, and can you tell us why you did it? Just give people a sense of it, and for those that haven't read it, and then why you did that, what drew you?
Well, I went to a sweat lodge weekend, and I'd never done one before. After that sweat lodge, I had a powerful experience in the sweat lodge. After that, I had a repetitive dream for 3 weeks where I was always in this pine forest. There were women, Native American women, beading. There were fires. There was singing and drumming. And I would wake from that same dream every morning, and I would smell the smoke from the fire, and I would hear them all day singing. And I found myself quite startled by that. I'd never had such a powerful repetitive dream experience. So I went to the person who'd run the sweat lodge, and I'd been given very specific instructions in those dreams that happened every night also. And he said to me, you're being called to a Sundance. And so...
Did you know what a Sundance
No, I had no idea. I'd never heard of it before. And it's a ceremony that happens when the choke cherries turn black across the Midwest of America. It's mostly been practiced by the Lakota, but it also is practiced by several other tribes. And it is designed for the health of the community, for the health of the people, for the health of the world. And it's 4 days preparation, 4 days of dancing from sun up to sundown, no food, no water, being sweated morning and evening in sweat lodges, very hot sweat lodges with no water, and then 4 days of recovery. So it's a very intense ritual. It's highly ritualized. There's a Sundance chief. He is descended from Sundance chiefs. There's an enormous amount of magical ritual that comes into it. And so I did that thing that I have only learned recently, that maybe I don't understand what risk is really, and I got on a plane and I went to America. I'd been connected with people who could help me into that journey, and I went down to New Mexico, to Arizona, and went out on a vision quest for a number of days just with my blanket, and fasted, and that was a preparatory exercise. I had to do that if I was going to present myself to a Sundance chief. And then I drove up to Oregon, which happened to be where this particular Sundance family were holding the dance. And I presented myself to the Sundance chief up there, and he said to me, after some conversation, I must say, yes, you can dance, but you must come back every year for 4 years. A Sundancer has to do a 4-year commitment. And he said, and you can't fail at that. And we all know how hard commitment is, and we all know that it's easy to fail at commitment, even the ones we make in front of our friends and families and think they're going to last forever. This was really hardcore commitment, and I knew I couldn't fail, and so I ended up going back every year to America for the summer, and I danced in 4 different locations with my Sundance family, and that led me to here in many ways, because it changed my brain. The thing about Sundancing and Native American life is that it brings the natural world alive in a way that I had sensed in those times I was out there fishing with Granddad, and I'd sensed by running around in the wild forests of Tasmania, and I'd sensed laying in rivers and in the ocean, body surfing, all of that, but it brought it even more vividly alive. And there is just nothing about this world that is not connected. And the thing that we seem to miss so much as humans, and have missed so spectacularly given the current circumstances, is nature's importance to us. So that changed my brain.
Had any other white Australian woman gone and done this before?
I've never heard of anyone else.
No. So it was quite unique. And do you think of it as searching on your part or a calling? How do you see it?
Probably both. I mean, I certainly felt called, those dreams, and then everything that followed on from that over the next 4 years totally supported me in that commitment. I took at that stage I had a little 2-year-old. I took him with me when he was 3 and when he was 5, and we did these crazy, I mean, I've done something like 20,000 road miles across America and through that period of time, more since. But yes, it was a magical time. I felt enormously blessed to be allowed in. I felt, it's not something that would probably even happen very much anymore. I think that they've closed a lot of the dances to non-Indigenous people to protect the ways. I've certainly held it very close to my heart, and even writing about it, I've tried to do that in a way that is the most honouring, but it is my story.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned by this stage you've had a child, first child. Did motherhood change things for you? Did it heal any of the grief? Did it give you a whole new sense of being? How did motherhood affect you?
It's a lot of fun. I mean, I think that was the biggest thing for me, was how much fun it was and how delightful it was to have someone who wanted to have fun every day as my companion.
Play with you.
To play, yeah, let's go play. Yeah. And I had a very serious job in advertising then, so I lived this very strange life of being in advertising in Melbourne, and I had this big account that I was taking care of. And I was, the head of fashion for Meyer Grace Brothers. And then I'd run off to America and dance in this extraordinary ritual. So it was a life of polarity, but motherhood is so grounding for me. It's the most fun thing to do, and yes, it's exhausting, and yes, it asks more of us than we ever think we have to give. But the joy of my children and the relationships that I've had, I never knew I would give birth to 3 of my best friends. So, that's a magical thing to do. And what I love is how much they have been part of my spiritual life, and they roll their eyes and, oh, Mum, she's so wacky and all of that. But it's something for them too, that they have the opportunity to reach into that space and take what they need from it too.
Right. I did ask permission to ask you this question. I wondered if you were ever worried that you might be exploited by somebody, or that you were prey to charlatans or cult figures, or, did that ever concern you, or even on reflection, does it concern you?
I certainly was alert to some pretty strange people floating around in the Native American space. That seemed evident in Australia and not a little bit in America, because I went to some other gatherings and, you know, there were some colourful people associated with Native American stuff who were not Indigenous. I think it's a risk. I think I've got a pretty good bullshit detector and I think that hopefully that's stood me in good stead. Yeah. Mostly I think when you're a Tasmanian, you know, you just sort of... I think it's a very grounding thing to be, yeah? There's not much to prove because nobody thinks very much of you usually anyway, so it's a good place to come from, you know? And in Melbourne, in advertising, is, you know, in those days... this is long before Mona and Tasmania's sort of rebirth as a cultural centre. You know, I had 30 or so jokes on stuck on my door of my office in the advertising agency that were all about inbred Tasmanians. Like, I've heard them all, yeah, the second head and all of that. You know, it was a lovely, humbling thing to be, being a Tasmanian. So I don't think charlatans... thought I was very good bait, probably.
You weren't good prey. However, you know, it's the grief, level of grief that sometimes people do prey on, you know, and, well, that's a judgmental statement.
Well, I didn't
statement.
Talk about that, no. Of course.
A judgmental statement, of course, on my part. And but, you know, so it's really lovely when you read your story that actually most of these things were pretty affirming and added value to your life.
Yeah, or completely, yeah. Yes.
I just want to talk now about writing a memoir. And did you see that as a, you know, I think there was a moment in time when you felt it was important to write this. So can you talk to us about that? Why a memoir and why at that time?
Yeah, I turned 50 and I got quite unwell, and my children had been asking me to write things down, especially the recipes, for a long time, and other people had asked me and said, you know, it would be good for you to write those stories down. And I actually thought, as I said at the beginning, that it would free me from them. I'd never have to tell them again. It would be great. I started writing and then realised that I'd embarked on something that was much more powerful internally than I'd ever expected. It's not just a piece of journalism to recount your life. It's an interior exploration and a deep dive. And I think for those of you who are thinking about it, you know, it's not for the faint-hearted. You'll need a lot of courage if you're going to do it well. And I, my beloved knows this well. You know, many times I was just a puddle on the couch. You know, I never ever got through some of those passages without crying. Of course, you know, it doesn't go away. So it was really hard, and I would not recommend it. Let me say, I really wouldn't, unless you have some really good support structures. You know. And then, of course, the crafting, because I felt very responsible to all of you, because I had written by then 8 novels. And, of course, I learned a lot along the way of writing novels, and there's a very different mechanism and structure, and everything about a novel is very different from a memoir. I wanted you to have something that was of a similar standard of writing, but I'd never done that before. So I sort of had to do this grueling process of lifting the work and lifting the work and lifting the work, and that's why it took me, you know, 8 years to craft it until it felt as if it was worthy of, you know, my better novels.
It's interesting. And I mean, obviously one of the things you worry about is the consequences for others that are in the book, and absolutely. I'm sure you did. And what about now that you've written the book? Has anything changed in terms of family, relationships, you know, and indeed the way people have dealt with the reading of it?
Yeah, I did... make sure that all my children read the pieces that were associated with them, and I asked them if they wanted to use their real names in the book, and two of them didn't want to use their real names because for various reasons. And I certainly shared... There's a story I recount early on. So I lost my brother, and my best friend lost his brother just a couple of years later, and I wrote to his mum, who is a dear friend still, but I sent her a note and I said, look, I've shared a little bit of your story. Are you okay with that? And she told me the most amazing thing. She said they had never had a grave for him or any sort of plaque, and she'd felt bad about that over the years, and they handled the story of that their story very differently to my family. And she said that now he would live always in the book. And I would have written it for that alone, you know. In terms of my parents, my dad loves the book. He says it's the book we all needed you to write. And I think it's freed them. Both of them seem more free. Neither of them had ever read the coroner's report until I dug it up in the process of writing the memoir. I think there's been more self-forgiveness for all of us about how we did our best. We all did our best to cope with that early thing, and it's led us forward in life. And I think for my sister too, she really gets that, oh, we were damaged. And she went on to become an emergency nurse, and she told me a story once of she's in the emergency department with a group of her colleagues, and of something like 14 of them, 9 or 10 of them had lost a sibling in an accident. So that's, yeah. That's so we do these things. We make these choices beyond to come to some form of wholeness again.
And a lot of the damage, it seems to me, in this is in the silences. And Nick's family, as you say, dealt with it completely differently. Has the silences been broken? Are you talking more now and, you know, about the situation, but also to each other? Or
we've all had conversations. I think we are. I think there's been a healing in it for my brother too. He's been reaching out more. And, you know, I don't think Mum will ever be okay. And what it did is that I hadn't expected, and the book is dedicated to my mum, is it took it from just being her story, because she actually believed really truly that it was her story, and I don't think she'd ever understood that it had really affected the rest of us. So at first that was really hard for her, but she does seem very light-hearted at the moment. And, you know, my dad's 89, Mum's 85. You know, they're doing really well. They've done a spectacular job of living beyond that and holding a sense of family together even through the difficulties.
I want to circle back to the name of the book, Nothing Bad Ever Happens Here. Can you tell us how you came to decide upon that name? And
yeah, well, it's almost like an invitation. It's maybe nothing bad ever happens here. Because when I finally went back, and I tell this in the memoir, I finally went back to the place that Grandad and Byron had died. I'd never been there in, you know, 40 years, even though it's quite close. It's on the Tasman Peninsula. I had a sense of that. I had a sense that somehow, regardless of everything that it had brought in the devastation and also in the gifts, the extraordinary gifts of that experience that have resonated for all of us, especially for me, because I can only speak to that, there was a sense that maybe nothing bad ever happens here. And it's an almost impossible thing to conceive because we're so caught in our human drama. We're so caught up in the stories that we hold on to that somehow identify us, and sometimes we choose to be victims and sometimes we choose to be martyrs. And, you know, there are sort of identikits for each of us that help us feel strong in the world or help us have some sense of certainty. But if everything's okay because we only know about 5%, that 95% of everything that's here is dark energy or dark matter, and if only 5% of what we think of as reality is reality, and it may be much less than that, we may find that out, then who knows what's really going on? I don't know. I mean, we can all speculate. But there are gifts everywhere if we look for them. It's a mindset, and that's partly why I had the opportunity to live from pain or to live from joy. And strangely, the more joy I've managed to feel, the less pain I feel. And that was brought out of a chronic illness. But the sense that if we get to choose joy over and over and over again in everything we do, in all our iterations, and it's always a choice, then really maybe nothing bad ever happens here.
What? I just noticed I've completely been devoid of timing and we've only got a couple of minutes left. So what brings you joy now? What do you do physically? I mean, obviously your family and cooking and all those things. What do you do now that brings you great joy? Where's your solace? Where's your happy place?
Well, my beloved.
Yeah.
And the life that we have created. We bought ourselves 65 acres of the most magnificent land in Tasmania, and we wander about and just delight in life. Every day I see something I haven't seen before. It's a spectacular place to live. Put me in the sea and I'm always joyful. Put me in a river and give me good friends and good conversation, and that is always a very joyful thing too.
Because we're in Byron, and I just wondered if you can finish on that little story of swimming, because you're an ocean swimmer, which I am too, so I honed in on this, in the bay with the dolphins and with, you know, can you talk about that just to finish up?
Yes, I had some of you will have had similar experiences. I was swimming, I'm a big ocean swimmer, and I was swimming on this particular day up the beach where I used to live, and suddenly a pod of dolphins came in around me, and there was a mother and a baby at first, and then 7 of them came in around me, larger and smaller ones, and we swam for about 200 metres. I was just doing freestyle with a mask and snorkel, so you imagine how slowly they had to go to, to slow down to my pace. And then they started, because I've got the mask on, I'm watching them start to clearly jump. And it was a still morning in Hobart on the Riverdale, and I put my head up, and there are rainbows of light because they're throwing all this sea up into the air, and there's the sun coming up. And I remember thinking, oh, I'm going to die now. This must be what death is. This is all right. And then I turned and looked at the shore and I saw two people standing there. I thought, oh, no, the cars are still there and people are still there, so maybe not death. And then so I just kept on swimming, and eventually it was just the mother and the baby again, and then they swam away. And when I went back into shore, the two people met me as I came out of the water, and they said, how extraordinary. And it was so beautiful to know that there'd been witnesses, because it was really hard to believe that it actually happened, that it was magical.
Mm-hmm. Well, a roller coaster, and what a fabulous story. And thank you so much for speaking with us today. Would you join with me in thanking Heather Rose?
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can find more of our festival conversations online at byronwritersfestival.com/digital.